Did President Trump betray Israel again? What has replaced US Treasury bonds as the world's largest reserve asset? And are Britain's police racist? We're going to answer all of these questions and more on today's Trumpet World.
I want to just show you today that President Trump betrayed Israel. Now, that's a strong statement, but there's all kinds of proof to show you that happened. Why would that happen, and how would that happen? President Trump does not really have a strong military leader to advise him. Here, if you look at this and just say, well, what is it that President Trump really needs? Well, he needs somebody to help him understand what is happening in the Middle East. And he has to see in time what a catastrophe he has caused in the Jewish state in the Middle East, our only real ally. And they have been a strong one. And now, where does that leave us in the Middle East? What kind of power do we have there? Well, it's not encouraging.
That was Mr. Gerald Flurry back in January 2025, after President Trump stepped in to stop Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel from finishing the job in Gaza. It's worth remembering and going back to that Key of David this week, because President Trump did the same thing in Lebanon, stepping in to prevent Israel from finishing off Hezbollah in Beirut. To get the latest on this story and how it ties into the Iran peace negotiations, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, Israel announced an incoming massive barrage against Dahiya, which is the southern suburb of Beirut, where Hezbollah is headquartered. The Israel Defense Forces have been pushing against Hezbollah and have been trying to use the latest momentum, as well as the imminent threat of a ceasefire with Iran, to push forward and get rid of Hezbollah once and for all. When Israel said that, Iran announced that they were walking away from ceasefire negotiations with the United States because of Israel, because Israel was acting in bad faith, quote unquote, and that therefore everything's off. This prompted a very tense phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over Israel's strikes, because Israel went ahead with everything anyway, where, according to sources speaking with media, this was one of the tensest, almost ruptures in the relationship you've seen between these two men since President Trump took office last year. And since then, Israel has scaled back its intended attacks. There have been on and off claims of a ceasefire. Hezbollah has never pretended to even keep them. And as of yesterday, they officially announced they are rejecting the ceasefire. Israel says that the ceasefire was with the Lebanese government, not with Hezbollah, that it concerns Hezbollah, but Hezbollah doesn't have a say in what goes on. So if Hezbollah doesn't drop its weapons, Israel will disarm it. But again, this is all in the context of the peace negotiations between the United States and Iran, and Israel and its war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran's most important proxy, both in military power and proximity to Israel, is increasingly being dragged into the conflict, and Iran is using the negotiations to twist Israel's arm to back off from attacking Hezbollah.
Yeah, it's a very concerning news story. We saw the language, at least as Axios reported it, on the phone call between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu was very profane. It sounded like he was just yelling, almost berating Benjamin Netanyahu, language that he seems to only use against allies, and you very rarely hear him talking to enemies that way. But it's worth tying it in, I think, to what happened in January 2025, when he kind of forced this ceasefire on Israel and Gaza instead of finishing the job. Same thing again now. He does have this belief that he can just solve all of these problems through negotiation, and he doesn't understand the irrational evil that he's facing in groups like Hamas, in groups like Hezbollah, and in people like Iran. Melanie Phillips just has an outstanding article today titled President Trump, a Second Obama, which is just a pretty condemning title by itself. I mean, she concludes President Trump is now at serious risk of turning into a second Obama. Not just Israel, but the entire free world should be alarmed because of the way he just keeps trying to talk to Iran. And okay, there are important differences. You know, I think Barack Obama was deliberately going out there to undermine American power and was willing to work with American enemies in order to do that. Donald Trump, I think, is more fueled by a naive belief in the power of negotiation. But he just doesn't, well, as Melanie Phillips says, Trump thinks every problem can be solved by a deal that only he has the skill to pull off. He doesn't seem to grasp that some agendas are so uncompromising, they're simply non-negotiable. I think this arrogance is a big weakness. This, in particular, this belief in himself as a deal maker. Because instead of looking at Iran's past behavior and concluding, this is an evil that cannot be negotiated. You know, we can't make a deal with the devil. You can't solve World War II by doing a deal with Adolf Hitler. This is just an evil that has to be defeated. Instead of looking at their past behavior and reaching that conclusion, he looks at that past behavior and says, the previous negotiators were not as good as me. They failed to produce a deal, but I am so much better than them, so I will. The reality is, as Melanie Phillips goes on to write, Trump's insistence on a deal has given Tehran the scent of victory in its nostrils. For the regime, a deal represents the surrender of America. Every negotiation is viewed as a sign of American weakness and a spur to redouble its attacks. For the regime, the purpose of these negotiations is not to get the best deal possible for Iran. It's to force America to surrender. And she points out, any deal will be worthless. The Iranian regime is a world-class cheater that has never kept any terms of any deal it's ever made, never observed any ceasefire, telling lies reflexively in accordance with the Islamic principle of taqiya, which makes it mandatory to lie in the cause of Islam. So, completely foolish. And in doing this, he's holding back Israel from defeating Hezbollah. And I think one thing I've appreciated from Melanie Phillips, but a number of other writers coming out of Israel this last week, is we've kind of moved on from October 7th, and that's very much in the rearview mirror. Attacks are a regular part of everyday life in northern Israel. Hezbollah is raining down missiles just hours after the supposed ceasefire, and Donald Trump pushed Israel to climb down. Well, Hezbollah sent another drone into northern Israel. 25,000 Israelis had to go into bomb shelters. People are regularly under attack. And President Trump is stopping Israel from using this fantastic opportunity to really make some long-term progress in dealing with that evil from Hezbollah. So a tragic situation from President Trump, but one that Mr. Flurry latched right onto back in January, even as Donald Trump was just first coming into office.
Yes, one of the points Ms. Phillips makes in her article is that the fact that Iran scrambled this quickly with calling off the negotiations, everything like that, it showed that what Israel was going to do in Lebanon was genuinely something that concerned them, was a weak spot, that if Iran didn't do something, they were going to lose out. And her point was that should have been a signal to America that you could use Israel as leverage against Iran. And instead, Trump used Iran as leverage against Israel. One observer that I've spoken to about this, he summed it up this way. What we are seeing from the phone call is that the United States is being played by Iran and Trump is falling for it. Now, again, there's a difference between what Barack Obama was doing compared to what the current administration is doing. In that case, it was deliberate and intentional and trying to mask it as naivety at best to the public to conceal their actual motives. In this case, you could say it is actual naivety, lying by arrogance, as you mentioned. But it's still the same tactic, and the president is just going right along with it, no matter what signs are coming up ahead to show that this approach is being fruitless. On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the president would restart the war only, quote, if Tehran kills American troops. That's according to insiders. They were interviewing. And the day after that, President Trump, in a media conference at the White House, said that, that he was asked why he hasn't restarted the bombing campaign despite all of the violations of the ceasefire by Iran, by its proxies. And he said, quote, "In that part of the world, ceasefire is when you're shooting in a more moderate manner." That, first off, that's not a ceasefire. B, Iran looking at that language, Hezbollah looking at that language, they're going to take that and run with it. So in other words, a ceasefire is only a ceasefire, put another way, when Israel is forced to abide by it, but nobody else is.
I think one of the things that both Melanie Phillips and then Mr. Flurry back in January really zoomed in on as well that I appreciated is what this says about America's fighting spirit. I mean, this does expose some things about Donald Trump. I mean, this is Mr. Flurry said that back in January. This is clip two.
But I'll tell you this, what Mr. Trump has done here is going to plague him from the very beginning to the end of his tenure in office. That is a fact that, and you wait and see if it doesn't happen that way, unless there's a big change in what he's doing. He has disgraced Netanyahu, and it's just a catastrophe that it's hard to even describe.
You know, Mr. Flurry said back then it would be a curse or something that would plague Mr. Trump's time in office, but it also says something about the lacking fighting spirit in America. Here's another clip from that Key of David. So this is clip one.
Mr. Netanyahu is surely one of the outstanding leaders of the world. I look forward to working with you. And how much does he know about fighting wars? He's been doing it most of his life in Israel or Judah. That's just the truth. But President Trump has rejected both of those men as far as them leading him in his understanding. So I'll tell you, this has exposed Mr. Trump in a way that none of us want to see, but it is the truth. Something is dreadfully wrong here. What is it?
There is some fighting spirit in Israel and with Benjamin Netanyahu, and he really is an outstanding warrior. But a lot of that is lacking in the United States. And I think this, Melanie Phillips made a fantastic point where she said, behind Trump's strategic errors, however, lie a more profound and more profoundly worrying issue. The Iran war is deeply unpopular with the American people. In part, that's because Trump has never made the case to them that it's being waged because Iran poses a mortal threat to America itself. But mostly it's because American humiliation in Iraq and before that Vietnam, along with decades of anti-Western propaganda in American schools and universities, has now made Americans viscerally averse to boots on the ground anywhere and any U.S. troops being placed in danger. A culture that no longer accepts the need for sacrifice in the cause of a just war is a culture that has no future. I mean, that's exactly true. And that is exactly the Bible's analysis of what has gone wrong. It's broken will. America's will, is like Leviticus 26 says, God said, I will break the pride in your power. This is what we were saying right from the start of the Iran war. You go back to the April issue of the Trumpet magazine this year, where we were sending this to the press just a few weeks into the war. I suggested holding back, not sending it to the press until the war was over, in which case we'd still be waiting to send the April issue to the press. But one of the articles there, will America win? And the article says, no, America won't, because of its sins. Because of America's social problems. You know, these sins have broken America's will. And then God adds curses and God additionally breaks America's pride in its power, breaks America's will on top of that. And the article's all built around what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote years ago, where he was talking about why America's wars were failing, why Korea wasn't an American victory, why the Bay of Pigs didn't work out for America. Melanie Phillips mentioned Vietnam. And Mr. Armstrong said, you know, well, whose fault is this? Why is this? And he said, and I quote, "It is the fault of you, all of you." In all caps, that's where what he wrote. "You have departed from your living God. You are worshipping at the shrine of pleasure, luxurious living, material interests. You are in a moral toboggan slide, and although your lands are full of churches wherein you conduct pagan worship, your lands are also full of fornication and adultery, full of crime, full of vanity, greed and selfishness, full of lying, dishonesty, graft, full of cheating, stealing and murder, full even of injustice in your courts." I mean, America lacks the will to fight evil because of sin, because there's no willingness to sacrifice, to go without, and to sacrifice pleasant conveniences for future survival even. You know, sometimes we like to tell ourselves, well, because we like peace, we're righteous. But peace at any price is not righteous. Peace that comes from compromising with evil is not righteous. I mean, there are plenty of times where God condemned people for avoiding violence in the Bible because their motives were wrong. Now, if America said, hey, we're going to trust in God to defend us, we don't need to take up arms against Iran, and we're going to have faith in God to protect us and deal with us, well, that might be a different situation. But that's not what America is doing right now. So I thought it was just some outstanding analysis from Melanie Phillips pointing to the same thing. Your President Trump has made a lot of mistakes here. But part of the reason why he's stuck, and we've got the week after week of the war still in limbo, the strait isn't open, but we don't have a peace deal, is, you know, he doesn't want to accept the peace deal on Iran's terms, but he doesn't have the backing of America's people to really deal with the problem. And so we're stuck. And the cause of that stuckness and the cause of rising Iran is America's sins. And ultimately, you know, that rising Iran, it's going to trigger that whirlwind response from the Holy Roman Empire, from the King of the North in Europe in Daniel 11. And that whole situation exists because of America's sins. And God is raising up Europe to correct America because of America's sins. That's what we're looking at here. I'm afraid I keep getting carried away and stealing your conclusions, Mihailo. But, if you would like any more information, if our readers would like any more information or listeners, there's that April Trumpet print article that I mentioned, Will America Win? We can put a link to that in our show notes. What else do you have for us from the Middle East this week?
One other story in a bit of a opposite direction, you could say. This technically started last week, but it's still ongoing. Israel announced that it has taken control of about 60% of the Gaza Strip. If you go back to the ceasefire with Hamas in October last year, the one that's supposed to be ongoing, they had just over 50%. Now they have 60%, and they said they're going to be aiming for 70% now. And Mr. Netanyahu, when he announced that, said, let's start with that. So they may even go far further than that. That is technically a violation of the ceasefire. Hamas has been violating the ceasefire this whole time, but this would probably be the biggest blatant upturning of the status quo in Gaza since October. Now, those comments from Mr. Fleury, they were about Mr. Trump's dealings with Gaza, and as you mentioned in the quote there, or as we played in the quote there, he said that if Mr. Trump doesn't turn things around, that this is going to plague him for the rest of his time in office. He seems to be turning a blind eye to Netanyahu pushing forward in Gaza, probably because Hamas has refused to. Like you said, Hamas wants the ceasefire, wants the peace deal on their terms, and Trump doesn't want to give them that. They don't want to withdraw their weapons. They don't want to surrender their land. So this may be an opportunity or the best case scenario for that to happen, and so he's turning a blind eye to it. When the news cycle inevitably focuses its gaze on Gaza again and sees what Israel is doing, and there's more bad headlines, we'll see if he changes his tune. But for now, the war in Gaza is still going on. Things haven't been settled there. We've spoken before on this program how we expect Germany eventually to become Israel's main backer in Gaza and even help a change in government that looks like it's in Israel's favor, but it's actually, again, another attack on Israel. Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, details all of that.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Several stories from Britain this week point to just abhorrent injustice throughout the policing system, the justice system. These are stories that haven't just shocked the nation, they've shocked the world. One of these, the most famous story, that of 18-year-old Henry Nowak, has captured the attention of the U.S. White House. They've criticized Britain for really what is anti-white racism going on with Britain's police. So Nowak was walking home alone. You probably heard the story already. He was stabbed 5 times with an 8-inch knife by a 23-year-old Sikh attacker. The police showed up and promptly arrested Nowak for racism. Nowak, you know, he said he'd been stabbed. He said, just like George Floyd, repeatedly, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I've been stabbed." The officer replied, "I don't think you have been, mate." Didn't look like they checked him all that thoroughly. They put him in handcuffs, and the last words he heard were the police reading him his rights as he was arrested. And the whole story is one of anti-white racism. For anyone else, carrying an 8-inch blade alone would have been illegal, but Sikhs are exempt from that law because of their religion. I mean, I'm completely against all of the knife regulations that we have in Britain anyway. It's really stupid that you can get arrested just for carrying a knife, but that's a bit of a different story. But here you still see a different standard. Everyone's not allowed to carry a knife, apart from Sikhs. They're allowed to. And then Hampshire's Constabulary, they say their top priority is being anti-racist, ethical, and inclusive. So they come along and they handcuff the white guy. And they just immediately believe what the ethnic minority is telling them. And then even as it continued, Henry Nowak's father spoke about this. Basically their racism continued. So once they realized, okay, you know, it was too late, once Henry Nowak had died, and they realize, okay, he has actually been stabbed. And they arrested Vikram Digra, this Sikh man. They arrested him, but they didn't put handcuffs on him. You know, white 18-year-old white guy being racist, he needs to go in handcuffs right away. 23-year-old Sikh who stabbed someone, well, you know, we need to be respectful. We don't need to put them in handcuffs. And he's kind of treated with kid gloves throughout this encounter. You're taken into the kitchen in the prison, and you know they treated him with respect and dignity, but not the white guy. And what we've had from the politicians has been, you know, we don't want to talk about this. No, we can't look at institutional racism within the police. They don't want to talk about this, but very clearly. You know, this is anti-white racism. And we've seen all kinds of signs of it, but this is just one dramatic, dramatic picture of that. And this is a curse. This is a prophesied curse, just like the pride of and our power being broken in America. I mean, you can see the same kind of dynamics. We've done this to ourselves. Britain's elected leaders have invited in 10 million people over the last 20 years, at least. They're probably undercounting migration statistics. And then they've silenced criticism. They've put in hate speech laws. They've had all of these DEI mandates. They've retrained the police because of what happened in America under George Floyd. Different country, different system. That still had all kinds of people taking the knee. But no response to the institutional racism exposed with Henry Nowak. I mean, we've seen all kinds of two-tiered policing. You saw this, I think this took place in Southampton, same place where you had that killer go stab those little girls. And immediately the government starts clamping down on anyone who would speak out about what that killer did. You know, somebody vents their anger, somebody who's been affected personally by these kind of tragedies. They write something up online in the heat of the moment, decide, okay, well, that's a bit harsh, that's a bit insulting, delete it. But still, they've got, you know, they go to jail for ages. None of these other people involved in these crimes are prosecuted like that. I mean, this Vikram Digwa's whole family conspired against Henry Nowak. You know, they helped him hide, his mother, I think, helped him hide the knife. His family supported his lie. Said, yeah, no, it was a racist attack. I don't think any of them have been punished. But if somebody complains about anti-white racism online, well, they've got to go to jail. We've got to throw the book at them. But this is, as I said, a curse. It's one that we've brought on ourselves, but it's one that, again, God is adding his punishment to. Deuteronomy 28, verses 43 to 44. It talks about foreigners coming in, and the stranger shall get up above thee very high, and he shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. And that's what's happened all over Britain. It's most dramatically here, but that's what happens in job interviews. And in the criminal justice system, I mean, this is a nation sick from head to toe. And we got another glimpse of that from Britain, where you're getting teenage boys convicted of rape and the judges, letting them go with ridiculously tiny fines. That was a story exposed by The Guardian, where you had three separate cases of teen boys convicted of rape and serious sexual assault. And their punishment for these three different individuals was a £26 fine. As people pointed out, that's less than a parking ticket. According to this judge, for a teenage boy to rape a girl, well, that's less serious than somebody parking in the wrong place or returning 10 minutes late to where they've paid for parking. You had an attack where one involved a knife, and the attack was videoed for social media. And the judge, Nicholas Rowland, he justified the light sentence, saying, well, we didn't want to criminalize these children unnecessarily. We wouldn't want to criminalize a rapist unnecessarily. We don't have to do that. And in many of these cases, the subtext, not all, I don't think, but in many of them, the people doing the attackers are migrants or children of migrants, and then they get reported as being British. Again, just like this Southampton stabber from a while ago, where all the reports said he was British, and then only later do we find out, okay, he was born in Britain, but his parents both came from, I think it was Rwanda. Mr. Hilliker wrote about this on June 1st, judges who refuse to lay down the law. He goes through how it's an American problem too. And talks and showed how all of these different judges were in all these cases across the US doing the same thing. I mean, really just upside down, abhorrent judgments coming in our society. I mean, it's a dangerous symptom of decline. Well, not just decline, of moral rottenness. Just like, I mean, it is the same as Iran. These are all symbols or symptoms of a society that is sick of sin or sick with sin. We'd be fed up with sin, but this June, it's so-called Pride Month, where you have all these people trying to celebrate perversion, nation-destroying perversion, will-destroying perversion, perversion that destroy, it's no coincidence that it's these woke judges and police that are all on board with rainbows and sending people for jail for saying nasty things about protected minorities, including those into perverse sexual practices. These are the same ones that are handing down £26 fines for rape. Their minds have been warped by the ideologies that they've embraced. It goes... it goes hand in hand with the LGBT movement, as it's called. And God outlaws these perversions for a reason. So all of this is destroying our societies. And this is why God is bringing on curses to our nations. And this is why God is raising up the Holy Roman Empire, why he's raising up Germany, why Europe is rapidly rearming. It's to correct Britain and the United States. And God is behind their rise. That's why it's part of the reason why it's happening so quickly. And it's going to continue to happen incredibly quickly. Now, our nations need correction. The only hope, and you look at how far Britain and America have sunk, and you see it, I think, more in Britain. I mean, maybe that's just because I live there and I notice it more. But you see it so much there, here, that it's easy to say, well, where's the hope? The hope is actually in the correction. Because we need radical, radical change. We need repentance. We need to get God back involved in the national life. And then we need to start not just talking about him, but obeying him. And not just obeying man's ideas of what God teaches, but what the Bible actually teaches. know, things like the Sabbath day being a test commandment of what do we put first, our own ideas or what the Bible actually says? Well, which day do we go to Sabbath services? Which day do we set aside for God? Is it Sunday, as the Catholic Church and the churches of the world command, or is it Saturday, as the Bible commands? No, it's a test commandment of who we listen to. That's why all of these, that's why God is cursing our nations, and that's where the hope is, in repenting, turning to God, and obeying him. But we've seen more stories of Europe's rising this week too. I'll just summarize a few of those quickly. We had Germany's economics minister going over to China for a three-day visit over, I think that was last weekend, or it finished on May 29th. An important story to watch, because Europe and China, they're going to team up temporarily as they bring down the United States. The Telegraph had a good article on June 1st, or might have been published online the day before, looking at the way so much of Europe is getting their civilians ready for war. It's not just about building the arms industry and making the bombs and training the soldiers, but they're also bringing their civilians onto survival courses and getting them into civil defense units or reservists, you know, training them on modern, you know, traditional survival techniques that you could have trained people in 100, 200 years ago. You know, just things like basic navigation, first aid, how to find food, but and then things like how to get to an air raid shelter, what to do when you hear an air raid siren, but then also, well, how not to give away your location with a cell phone, how to light a fire that thermal imaging cameras aren't going to pick up on. That's Poland that's been teaching those kind of things. Finland and Sweden have been mailing prepare for war leaflets to all of their households. Norway is expanding its civil defense force. You see similar things going on in Germany. Britain, Telegraph contrasts it with Britain. We've got no civil defense force, no course to prepare civilians. We've let our bomb shelters fall into disrepair. We haven't even put together a leaflet. We're really not at all prepared even physically for what is coming, but just more of Europe preparing for war. And America is thinking about now sending more nuclear bombs to Europe. The Financial Times reported this week that the Trump administration has a plan to basically win back America, or win back Europe. They see that Europe is concerned about pulling troops out. And we did get another report today about America making much fewer resources available to NATO. So these are being pulled out. And instead, though, they're offering more nuclear bombs. They're in talks of stationing American dual-capable aircraft that can carry nuclear and conventional sites and presumably the bombs with them in Europe and Poland and some Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, some of them. They've expressed an interest. I think it's not a coincidence that this is coming as France's initiative to build a French nuclear umbrella over all of Europe is really taking off. And you had Friedrich Merz's security advisor, Günther Sauter, was in Paris recently to talk about this. You know, this is related. France is offering its protection, and I think this is a belated attempt from America to try and stop this coming off. But again, this is something prophesied in the Bible. Ezekiel 16 and verse 33, God says to the modern nations of Britain and America, they give gifts to all whores, but you give your gifts to all your lovers and hire them, that they may come unto you on every side for your whoredom. You know, where America is giving gifts. God says, you're like a prostitute that hires lovers instead of the other way around. But, I mean, what kind of gifts is it? You know, America's trying to win back Europe by giving gifts of nuclear weapons. And they're trusting in, I mean, America, Britain, we're trusting in, and Israel too, in the Middle East, as they see they can't depend on America. They're trusting in Europe instead of in God. And that's going to be a dramatic curse. But again, it's all leading to the nations trusting in God. The same time we see Europe depending on artificial intelligence or trying to separate their artificial intelligence from America this week. They're passing a European technological sovereignty package. So this is just proposals at the moment, but they want to make sure that they're not depending on America. So they're building major data centers. They're trying to build their own versions of the infrastructure. The companies that America uses try to make sure that European data can't be moved to the United States. So keep watching Europe to have their own efforts, their own independence when it comes to artificial intelligence or any of these different developments. And last week, Romania ordered $6.6 billion worth of military equipment from Rheinmetall. Another, another important story as Germany helps all of Europe to rearm. Well, moving on to the United States, we have an important symbol of America's economic decline. We've been talking a fair bit about America's spiritual or moral decline until now. But to get the latest on this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the past year has been a rough year for America's economic standing in the world. Its total national debt has surpassed $40 trillion, or is very near $40 trillion, right at that level for the first time in its history. Also, for the first time in its history, its public debt, that's the debt that it actually owes investors outside the U.S. government, has surpassed its total GDP. And the ongoing closure of the Strait of Hormuz has dropped its oil reserves to near its lowest level ever, probably will hit its lowest level ever by around Independence Day. And all these stories together have obviously made many nations question America's financial solvency, America's, the U.S. dollar's standing as the world reserve currency. And one really shocking statistics that highlights just how in question the dollar's reserve currency status is that for the first time since 1971, gold has now surpassed the dollar as the reserve currency of choice for U.S. central banks. Obviously, the U.S. sells treasury bonds to individuals and institutions and other than central banks. But when it comes to just central banks, a year ago, if you looked at the reserves in central banks, you would have seen that about 25% of those reserves were in U.S. dollars, 20% was in gold, 15% was in euros, and those were the top three, so then the remaining 40% wasn't anything else you can hold in reserve. Now this year, after all the financial turmoil I just described, the dollar share in central bank reserves has fallen by 3% from about 25% down to 22%, so a slight drop. Euros has stayed steady, 15% in both cases, whereas gold has actually spiked, a big spike, up 7% from 20% up to 27%. So if you were keeping track, we're now at a place where 27% of central bank reserves are held in gold and only 25% are held in dollars. As I alluded to a moment ago, it used to be that before America went off the gold standard in 1971 under the Bretton Woods Agreement, the dollar became the world's predominant reserve currency because it was backed by gold. But since dollars and gold were interchangeable, central banks tended to hold a lot of their reserves in gold. After the dollar was no longer backed by gold, but still the world's reserve currency, gold just no longer became all that useful to have sitting around. So the dollar's reserves built up until just recently, where now gold has just surpassed the dollar as the reserve currency of choice, as many of these central banks want something that they have confidence in is not going to inflate away.
So this is a big vote of, I guess, a vote of no confidence in America's economy coming from countries all around the world. Where do we expect this to lead?
Yeah, well, we're definitely keeping a close eye on this. We've mentioned on this program a number of times before that probably the late Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy or a personal prediction of his of how prophecy is going to unfold is that a financial crisis in the United States would be what caused 10 nations in Europe to unite into a super state with the financial and military power to conquer the United States. That's in Bible prophecy that there will be a 10-nation superpower in Europe. That's in Revelation 17. And then many other prophecies in Isaiah and Ezekiel and Hosea about that power conquering the United States. So the fact that this European superpower will conquer the United States is extremely prophetic. We call it Herbert W. Armstrong's greatest personal prophecy, as the Bible doesn't get into enough detail to specify that it's the financial crisis that's what finally causes them to unite. Mr. Armstrong thought it would likely that would happen, and subsequent events have really proved that he was right in that. I've even seen for years European leaders talking about how the euro needs to get its act together to unseat the dollar as the world reserve currency. Even now they're talking about, like, well, if we get a euro bond backed by the European Central Bank to give people alternatives. Because what this gold story tells us is that central banks do not have confidence in the US dollar. They want another reserve currency. Currently, your two main currency options for a new reserve currency are the Chinese yuan and the euro, both of which have probably even more problems than the dollar does. So nations are reluctant to switch over to those assets, but still don't want to hold dollars. So they're looking at gold as something that's not as interchangeable as a currency, but definitely holds its value. And so from here, we're expecting from prophecy that like probably this rise of gold's going to continue, the rise of the dollar's going to, the fall of the dollar is going to continue until there is another currency that's able to unseat the dollar. And that currency, I mean, I don't know if it will be the euro or what the European Central Bank's plan will ultimately be, but it will be a European-backed currency backed by a European superpower. I've even seen primarily German central bank figures even speculating that if they could actually get something where like a gold-backed euro to some extent, and the fact that like together all the nations in the European Union, if they pool their gold resources, they are the world's largest holder of gold. So a lot of these central banks buying gold are European central banks, Asian central banks as well. I think like Poland, Turkey, and India were the biggest buyers. And so that's the prophetic thrust of this, is looking for a European superpower to step in and exploit this desire, this goal for gold and this fear for the dollar to really revolutionize the world economic system. In a way that puts Europe on top and the United States as no longer the world's predominant financial or military superpower.
So a critical story to watch. What else do we need to pay attention to from the English-speaking world this week?
Yeah, well, still highlighting on this fact of the rise of the European superpower, we had one story that feels very important but didn't get much traction. In the mainstream media, is the Trump administration's moves in Cuba. Their economic blockade against Cuba is working. The government down there is getting desperate. There's rolling blackouts. There's food shortages. Although the goal of it is to force the Cuban Communist Party from power, not to starve the Cuban people. So the Trump administration is sending $100 million in humanitarian aid, food and medical supplies and other things to the Cuban people. They don't want this humanitarian aid to undermine their blockade and prop up the Communist Party, though. So the big condition with this humanitarian aid is they're not going to give it to the Cuban government to distribute, because they'll just keep it. They're going to give it to the Roman Catholic Church to distribute. So the Roman Catholic Church, which is very influential in Cuba, its logistic networks are probably more powerful than any organization in Cuba other than the Communist Party, so that they can make sure that the people get the humanitarian aid they need while the embargo keeps the pressure on the Cuban government. Of course, the other aspect of this is by making people reliant for their foodstuffs on the Catholic Church, it sets up the Catholic Church as a rival power center to the Cuban Communist Party. So there's definitely some strategy here into the best way to force the Communist Party from power. And I think that may get some good traction. But as we've also pointed out many times before, America is prophesied, if it doesn't repent and turn back to God, to be besieged by a Catholic-led Holy Roman Empire. This Holy Roman Empire that's going to be the next reserve currency, and that's going to be controlling more and more trade routes. And since 40% of U.S. seaborne trade goes through Gulf of America ports that come either through the Yucatan Channel or the Straits of Florida, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Flores, pointed out before that the Holy Roman Empire will need to control Cuba to complete a siege like that. And so this Trump administration plan to prop up the Catholic Church at the expense of the Communist Party is very prophetically significant in that way, by attempting to push communists out of Cuba at the cost of letting the Holy Roman Empire move in. Another story here about domestic turmoil in America. Many prophecies in the Bible, in Isaiah 1 and verse 7, and Ezekiel 5 and verse 12, Isaiah 3, about civil war-like conditions in America. And I think we saw more of that with like the radical left under Barack Obama and Joe Biden, basically trying to hijack the country and destroy the Constitution. Traditional American government values have had a resurgence under the Trump administration, but that doesn't mean the radical left has just given up or that threat of rioting and civil war has gone away. The Democratic Socialists of America are escalating their attempt to hijack the Democratic Party with more and more radical candidates, illustrated most powerfully this week by a new congressional candidate for the 13th Congressional District of New York, Avila Chevalier, endorsed by the Democratic Socialist of America and endorsed by New York Mayor Mondani, who, because of her endorsements, we suspected she was a left-wing radical. Now CNN's looked at 3,600 of her deleted social media posts, saying that the state of Israel needs to be abolished, private property needs to be abolished, the police need to be abolished, the U.S. border needs to be abolished. And saying that even though she is most versed in communist philosophy, there's one deleted post said that she's fascinated by the pyromania associated with anarchism. Communism being the philosophy that you need a dictatorial government run by the people in order to forcibly redistribute wealth. Anarchism being the philosophy where you actually need to destroy all government to create a stateless, classless society where property doesn't exist. So, ironically, the communist and the anarchist have the exact same goal of a classless, stateless society where property is non-existent. They just have different strategies to get there, whether you need to abolish all government right away or actually establish a dictatorship to defeat your enemies first. So the fact that she's actually looking like the pyromania associated with anarchism, I think really highlights that statement, whether she's involved or not, the type of violence we're prophesied to see in America if it doesn't repent, where Democrats come to realize that they can't fundamentally transform America from the inside out using the electoral process like they tried to do during the Barack Obama administration, but actually have to revert to more traditional anarchist and communist methods, like more along the lines of the Bolshevik Revolution than a frog in the pot, Saul Alinsky-style infiltration. And then one other story that's also just kind of a shocking statement to the moral situation of the nations of end-time Israel. This one not from America. We try to get the other English-speaking nations into this section occasionally. This one in Canada, where Mark Carney has established a new external advisory committee on anti-racism, particularly going after anti-Semitism in Canada, which seems like a great initiative. There's especially since the October 7th massacre from Hamas against Israel, there's been widespread anti-Semitism in Britain, the United States, and Canada, especially in the universities. However, ironically, this new commission against anti-Semitism by Mark Carney has included members like Omar El-Ghabra, who claims that the Alaska Martyrs Brigade in Iran are not terrorists and that Hamas does not want to eliminate Israel. So the new commission on anti-Semitism is actually more accusing the Jews of lying about Iran and Hamas being anti-Semitic. So it's very, very George Orwell style stuff here, where like the Ministry of Truth spread lies and the Ministry of Justice falsely accuses people and the Ministry of Peace creates war. The Ministry of Anti-Semitism has hired a bunch of people who believe that Hamas and Iran are the good guys in the conflict in the Middle East.
Well, another sobering and pretty disappointing news story. Thank you for that, Andrew. We'll look over now to Asia, where China is launching submarines faster than any other nation. We'll get an update on this and what it means from our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. I wanted to discuss this utterly unmatched pace of launches that China is in the midst of now with its attack submarines. There was an analysis about this in Naval News on Wednesday, and it details this rapid undersea buildup. It shows that they've launched 15 to 20 new submarines in the last 5 years alone, and that includes 8 new classes of submarine, and they appear to just keep getting more and more advanced and more lethal. The latest one was launched from a shipyard in Shanghai, the JN shipyard. The Chinese have not said anything about this new submarine, but images of it have been captured by satellite. That's normally how the situation goes with China's highly secretive submarine program. But with this latest model, from what we can see, it is quite a step up from previous designs. It's a nuclear-powered submarine, around 400 feet long and 35 feet wide. It also has X-form rudders and a sleek bow and very minimal sail. So all of that suggests remarkable levels of stealth that this is capable of, and also that it's capable of very high speeds. So this one was just launched this week, as I said, and it follows a major launch back in February of another new class of Chinese attack submarine. That one was believed to be the Type 095. And again, all we know about that one is what has been observed by satellites, since the Chinese are extremely secretive about this whole program. So both of these new subs are entirely new classes and very mysterious, but all indications are that they are significant steps in the development of this increasingly capable and increasingly deadly submarine force. Altogether, China is believed to now have between 55 and 60 attack subs, and at least 10 of those are nuclear powered, from what we can tell. So this force is growing in size and making major strides in capability. And meanwhile, in the United States, you have exactly the opposite picture taking shape here. The U.S. Navy released an analysis several years ago saying that to maintain its undersea warfare advantage over rivals, America needs at least 66 attack submarines. And so America's had several years to keep from being overtaken, but instead of using that time, the U.S. has apparently squandered it. The most recent data shows that America's attack submarine fleet has fallen to just 50 operational boats, and that number keeps on moving in the wrong direction. An analyst named David Axe wrote about this for National Interest. He wrote, quote, "America's submarine shortfall, which has been decades in the making, likely will get worse before it gets better. Even if the Navy could afford more subs, it lacks the shipyards to build them." End quote. So we have this situation now where China's building more and more attack submarines, and the U.S. is failing to build at a level that even begins to keep pace. So it is measurably shifting the balance of power for future naval battles. And this is something that we keep a close eye on at the Philadelphia Trumpet. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote an article in the August 2020 issue that's called "Where is the China-America Clash Leading?" And a good bit of this article is all about China's expanding naval power and the way it's using that to take over the South China Sea. And Mr. Fleury looks at it all through the lens of Bible prophecy. He especially focuses on a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 that's all about the U.S. losing control over sea gates and shipping lanes that it once had, and losing that control mainly to China. And with China's Navy becoming so powerful now, as we see with this buildup of submarines, it looks like China will be able to just keep on asserting more and more power over this area. And the South China Sea, you know, this is a region that America had kept open to world trade pretty much since the end of World War II. But now China is tightening its grip more and more over this area. And Mr. Fleury's article shows that this shifting power balance is fulfilling that prophecy in the book of Deuteronomy. So it's an important article to read as we see China's submarine fleet keep on growing and as we see its general naval power continue to increase.
So one question I've heard with various different things from China is, you know, China doesn't have much of a naval tradition. You go back, they've had some famous admirals kind of 500 years ago, but you know, they weren't a major naval combatant during, say, World War II or anything like that. They've got a lot to learn. Do we have any indication of the quality of the submarines that they're turning out here?
Well, as I said, at this point, only about 10 of their fleet are believed to be nuclear powered. So that would leave the other 45 or so as diesel powered. And those are far less capable. They're a lot louder, easier for adversaries to detect with radar and other, you know, espionage capabilities, things like that. So there is, from what I understand, a fairly massive gulf between the quality of the U.S. fleet and that of China. But China is trying to close that gap. And I think with these latest models, they are closing it. So we'll see how long that, you know, fairly significant quality gap remains in place.
And this is kind of news to me. I've not looked into it much. But when it comes to other areas of China, like fighter jets and things like that were written on years ago, it always felt like China would do something like produce a plane that was one-tenth as good as America's cutting-edge planes, but would cost one-hundredth of the price. So, it's not as good, but they were just able to churn out vastly more numbers of them. I guess you could have a kind of a similar dynamic going on here. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. What else do we need to pay attention to from the Asia region?
Yes, well, first up, a quick story here about North Korea's nuclear program. North Korean ruler Kim Jong-un announced this week that the nation's production capacity for nuclear weapons material has more than doubled over the last few years. And he said his people need to strengthen their arsenal by a, quote, exponential rate. So the North's nuclear firepower is quickly increasing, and if Chairman Kim gets his way, it'll continue to do so at ever faster rates. And then the last story that I wanted to talk about concerns Russian President Vladimir Putin's quest for longevity. It's become clear over the years that Putin is deeply fearful of death. Indications are that he believes this life is the only life there is, and so he clings to it like a drowning man holding on to a piece of floating wreckage. And a new report in the Wall Street Journal this week shows that Putin has spent as much as $26 billion of Russian taxpayer money to come up with different ways to buy himself another year, another week, another day. This report examines new gene therapy treatments that Putin's scientists are developing. It also talks about an initiative to print human organs in a lab, you know, 3D printing living tissue to replace anything in your abdomen that's no longer operating at factory specifications. The Russians are also working on something called xenotransplantation. This is growing human organs inside of pigs, a special breed of mini pigs that are genetically compatible with humans. So a lot of this sounds pretty sci-fi in some ways, pretty wild. But we do know that Putin was caught on a hot mic last year telling Chinese ruler Xi Jinping that he thinks people could achieve something close to immortality by replacing their organs. And this report shows that Putin is spending just obscene quantities of cash on these kind of initiatives, $26 billion, even as his country's in the midst of very serious economic hardship. So this is clearly a high priority for Putin, but I think that he would do well to remember that even billionaire dictators keep their appointments with death. He may be able to forestall it by a few years, but in the end, the house always wins.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. An interesting note to end on, but perhaps emblematic of the whole show. There is no hope in man. Where would you rather put your trust for immortal life? In organs grown inside a pig, potentially transplanted to keep you going a few more years, or in God's promises of the resurrection from the dead? This show, Bible Prophecy, is all about there is no hope in man, but there is endless hope in God. And he has a plan to invite everybody into his family. And you can read more about that in all of the literature that we have on our website, thetrumpet.com. We have a lot more material, a pretty big library of books and booklets that you can get there. You can get in touch with us as well at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We will be back on Wednesday next week. Thank you very much to all of our panelists, to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. And until we see you again, keep watching your world.